The Racing Post Bloodstock Postcast is sponsored by Racing FX, the UK's leading money services provider to the equine industry. Manage all your multi-currency needs in one cash manager account and spend anywhere in the world using the Racing FX multi-currency card sponsored by MasterCard. Payments to all service providers in the industry, at home or abroad, are quick and easy to manage via our unique equine network.
Hi there and welcome to a special Racing Post Bloodstock postcast. I'm Martin Stevens from the Racing Post Bloodstock desk. I have my colleague James Thomas here and we have a very special guest this time. He's one of the growing forces in the owner breeder ranks and he happens to own probably the most admirable filly in training. And he's also a nifty mover too. It's John Dance.
Not sure about my latter. Thank you for having me.
How are you?
Yeah, good, thank you. Yeah.
And still coming down after Laurence winning in France last week?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, we obviously went with fairly high expectations and, you know, to have an odds-on shot in a Group 1's pretty special. But, you know, when it actually happens, when she actually wins, it's, you know, it just feels like the dream started again. So, it's been a good week already, that's for sure.
And she put you through the ringer a bit during the race?
She did, yes, yeah. Yeah, I rang my wife actually after the race to say hello, and she said, "Are you all right?" And I said, "I think I've just had a heart attack." She said, "Well, your baby's just arrived." So back home, there was lots of ringing moments as well. Yeah, it was a pretty close call. PJ had said when he got off that she fell asleep for the first 7 furlongs, and he was delighted with that. He was really pleased to do that. It's just when he asked her to wake up again that we had a bit of a problem.
Yes.
But when she, when she eyeballed the other two horses, she knew what was going on, and she sort of said, "Leave it to me."
And there was a reason why I called her the most admirable filly in training. That wasn't just puffery. That's actually because she's got this amazing stride length. She digs in. She's a very good looking filly as well. I mean.
Yeah. I mean, she's absolutely stunning, and that's, you know. There's the name situation. She was already named, mm-hmm. Which was my daughter's name, so we had to have a look at her. But when I saw her, I'd never seen a horse so beautiful in my life. She was only a yearling, but I'd never seen a horse like her before, and I've not seen one since. She obviously wasn't to everyone's taste, so we wouldn't have been able to afford to buy her. But she was so beautiful. She struck you straight away. But yeah, she's got a lovely, long, galloping stride. She's a great mover. And you know, her will to win is just incredible. You know, if there's, you know, gets to the crux of a race and she's got half a chance, then you know she throws everything at it. You know, I think she's won 4 races out of 6, and I don't think any of them have been by more than a neck. You know, she's never. Yeah. I don't think at least she's never going to bolt up by 5 or 6 lengths, unless it was, you know, an incredibly easy race. But you know, it's just that will to win and make sure. Yeah. You know, she gets her head in front when it matters.
How tactically versatile do you think she is? Because that stride length sort of takes her to the front, doesn't it? And then does it make her a bit vulnerable, do you think? I know she's got, then she fights back. That's her.
Yeah, and that's one of the powers. Yeah, definitely. Mm. I think she is quite vulnerable, versatile.
Versatile.
Tactically.
Yeah.
Carl's form guy sent some statistics after Longchamp at the weekend. And he was talking about acceleration indexes. So, you know, obviously the last 2 or 3 furlongs versus the rest of the race. And the Guineas and her filly's mile race, the acceleration index was quite low because she'd gone such a fast pace, you know, in the gallop early doors. Whereas in France at the weekend, the first 7 furlongs were absolutely pedestrian.
Yeah.
And the last 3 furlongs were incredibly rapid, less than 35 seconds for the last 3 furlongs on good to soft. That's incredible.
Yeah.
The second last furlong, the penultimate furlong, was 11.1 seconds, which, you know, she wasn't doing those kind of times in the Guineas or the Filly's Mile for the last few furlongs because she'd gone so fast early. But so in terms of the pace of a race, she's versatile. It's just happened that we've ended up at the front in our last few runs. But, you know, the May Hill, she was deep in the pack and, you know, she might have been a bit keen and struggling to go slow enough at that point. But, you know, she was able to come off the pace and nail them at the line.
Yeah.
The Filly's Mile, she did the whole thing from the front. last weekend, obviously, we were on the front. In the ideal world, we'd kind of hoped that we might get a lead, because at home she does work better, you know, when she's got a lead and she's got something to pass. But as you say, she's got a quick stride, and she's pretty quick out the stalls as well. So you kind of end up at the front whether you want to be or not. But I imagine it'll be a very different tactical race in Chantilly for the Prix de Dianes.
So. Yes. And obviously now the Prix-Saint-Hollery is out of the way, what are going to be Lauren's short-term plans and then longer-term plans beyond the Prix de Dianes?
So Prix de Dianes is just over 2 weeks away, so that's obviously the first target. And then after that might slightly depend on, you know, how she runs. I don't mean result necessarily, but just whether she gives us the impression that she could stay any further. She kind of hinted that at Longchamp at the weekend. But as we mentioned, it was pretty slow early doors, and that can flatter how well you're staying at the finish. So I think it'll be a truer run race. They tend to go pretty hard at the start, fighting for position at Chantilly. So I think it'll be a truer run race and extra half furlong. You know, if we're finishing strongly then, you know, maybe we can look at stepping up to a mile and a half, which would bring, you know, possibly the Irish Oaks into the equation, the Yorkshire Oaks which would be a race I'd love to win, that's for sure. Yeah. And then, you know, shoot for the stars and, you know, maybe the arc after that.
Yeah.
If it looks like a mile and two is her trip, then be back to the drawing board a little bit, and I guess things like the Nassau and maybe even the Pretty Polly in Ireland come into the equation.
Yeah.
But yeah, we'll obviously have a better idea after Chantilly. But that's kind of the target at the moment.
And longer term, I want to pin you down here because I know you've said before there's a strong emotional attachment there. She's named, has the same name as one of your daughters. And she's obviously one of the first great horses that you've owned. And you've said you want to breed from her. But, I mean, she must be worth, what, say, 2 million now. And for that money, you could buy 10 quite good broodmares.
Yeah.
You could buy land, you could buy training fees. What are you thinking there?
It is tricky. If you look at the kind of money that Quiet Reflection and Marsha made last year, you know, she's multiple Group 1 winner. She's runner-up in the Guineas.
She's by Trendy Sire in Sydney.
Yeah, and she's, you know, and Pivotal's a great broodmare sire. So, you know, hopefully Sione ends up being likewise. But, you know, I'd like to think that physically she's an even better specimen than those two. So goodness knows what she might be worth. And yes, you know, we could sell her and that would give us, you know, we could buy a dozen really nice, you know, broodmares.
But
the emotional attachment is incredible. You know, she's already taken us to places where, you know, we never dreamt that we'd get to. You know, it was my aim going into last year was to get a listed win from something, anything. You know, you don't expect to dine at the top table. So a combination of what she's achieved and like, you know, the name thing.
Yeah.
I mean, and who knows what her offspring might be worth.
No, exactly.
You know, they
could. So if you did keep her, you'd probably maybe sell the colts, maybe, or
the fillies? Yeah,
possibly.
Yeah, I think we would probably sell the colts and keep the fillies. To a certain extent in my head, with the mares that we've got at the minute, I'm already kind of thinking that perhaps, you know, in order to protect the mares, we should be keeping the first foal regardless of what it is. Because,
right.
You know, they're not always a mare's best offspring.
No.
Although Quiet Reflection was quite a good first offspring for her dam, obviously. But but that would be the plan. That's kind of the plan with all the mares.
Right.
Sell the colts, keep the fillies.
So what can you tell us then about your young breeding operation that Lawrence will eventually join then? How many mares do you have? Where are they?
In our own name, that's my wife Jess and myself. We've got 20 mares at the moment. I think they're all at Southsea Forest Stud in Northamptonshire. And then we've got an interest in the ownership of both Pearl Secret as a stallion. But also a sort of a band of brood mares we bought to send to him, which I think there's 16 of at the moment. So I think we've just about got the majority share in most of those. So so they're like super commercial. Everything that they breed is going to be sold either as foals or yearlings. So yeah, no, it's a burgeoning band of broodmares, that's for sure, one way or another.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, there's some nice horses in there, hopefully.
Yeah. Yeah. How do you think, and how will you make it pay? Are you sort of looking at?
Yeah, I mean, it's. I think it's, you know, it'd be hard to make it pay as such, but you know, if we can kind of subsidise the cost of buying new horses by, you know, typically colts sell in the ring for more than fillies do, unless they've got incredible pedigrees.
Yeah.
But you know, the average colt would probably make more than the average filly, so that at least, you know, brings in a little bit of money into the coffers. And hopefully, if we can sell some nicely bred colts, they'll make good money, and you know, we can maybe buy slightly chancier colts for racing purposes. I'm sure PJ would love a stallion to retire off one day and the nominations that come with it. But yeah, that would be the plan. So it, you know, it's more of a way of sort of diluting the financial destruction that, that being an owner and a breeder could be.
I mean, given that you are relatively new to the ownership scene and the breeding scene, did you ever envisage you'd have gone so far so quickly?
No, not really. Actually, when we got into owning racehorses, I never really had any plans at that point to be a breeder. But then when you start falling in love with some of the fillies, and then also perhaps an understanding of the economics of the industry. You know, sadly, I'm an investment manager and a businessman, and, you know, suddenly, as my wife says, you know, your ability to turn a hobby into a business is really annoying. But you do start seeing perhaps better ways or more economic ways of making things pay. And that's, you know, what's allowed us to expand, you know, the numbers in training and the numbers in the breeding operation, just by, you know, trying to be a little bit savvy, you know, from a commercial sense.
You mentioned the band of 20 mares. Is there plans to expand beyond that, or
no? I think the numbers at least as high as it needs to be. The idea would be, you know, hopefully to just gradually improve the quality of that band of mares as time goes on. Again, you know, some of those mares are some of our ex-racers. Some hadn't raced but had good pedigrees, so we kept those. Yeah. And some are racers that, you know, like Marsh Pride would be one in the band now, who, you know, family pet. She went on debut with both my family and Jess's family there. First time we'd all been racing together, so it was quite a special moment. And then she went to Chester 4 years later for what would become her last race, and ended up being our first winner there. Jess and I couldn't make it, my parents went again. So she's very much, you know, in the family pet scenario. We love her, whole family loves her. And she, you know, she's really game as well. She probably lacked just the little turn of speed to make it, you know, sort of black type filly, but she was a, you know, top quality handicapper, great attitude. And, you know, when you get to know those horses, you think, well, that's a great quality to breed into the offspring. And if I can find the right stallions to make up the shortfalls in her physical ability, then hopefully you might breed something nice.
And what's she in foal to at the moment?
She's now in foal. She's gone to acclimation. So we've gone for the injection of injection of speed, the turn of pace that she kind of lacked. So and her family's kind of worked well with that line previously as well. So that's quite exciting.
So we'll come back after a break and we'll talk more about wider industry issues and have heated debate.
Yeah.
The Racing Post Bloodstock Postcast is sponsored by Racing FX, the UK's leading money services provider to the equine industry. Manage all your multi-currency needs in one cash manager account and spend anywhere in the world using the Racing FX multi-currency card sponsored by MasterCard. Payments to all service providers in the industry at home or abroad are quick and easy to manage via our unique equine network.
Okay, so welcome back to this Racing Post Bloodstock Postcast sponsored by Racing FX. Martin Stevens here, James Thomas, and our special guest John Dance. There's one more mare you wanted to mention, who you said was particularly close to your heart.
Yeah, there's a mare called Susan Stroman, and she is a half sister to the Fugue.
Yes.
Who was obviously a Lord Lloyd Webber horse, And she, the Fuga was always my favourite horse in training, you know, as a fan. Just loved the way she ran when she was at her best. You know, she would quicken on the bridle and put races to bed before she'd even had to get to work. She always used to take my breath away. So we were very lucky to buy her sister and foal to Zoffany, which would be closely related. Unfortunately, Dan Silly's, you know, no longer standing at stud. But we had a Kingman born this year.
Oh, well, yeah.
And she's gone off to Pivotal to be covered this year as well. But, yeah, if we could breed something that was not only closely related but also close in terms of ability to the Fuga, that would be another kind of breeding dream come true, honest. Yeah.
And so you're newish to the ownership ranks. Can you tell us how you got into it? How easy was it? And because it's a real industry concern now about how we get owners like you into the game, could industry bodies have done more to get you in quicker or more smoothly, or was it a smooth process anyway? What's your take on it?
I don't know if they could have done anything quicker. I've always been into racing, always followed racing. I do my own form analysis. And, you know, when we got our business up and rolling, you know, wanted to get our name around, you know, because of my love of the sport, the natural place to go to was Newcastle Racecourse.
Yeah,
you know,
this is Burton, which is based in the northeast.
Yeah, based up in just in the outskirts of Newcastle.
How do you call it? Not financial services.
Our wider group of companies is varied financial services. Right, yeah. Vertem's my main business in terms of a day-to-day operation, and it does investment management, stockbroking type services.
Yeah.
So you know, that's it's a kind of thing where you need to get your name out. You need to have a good brand because you know. You know, people are putting their money with you, so they need to know that, you know, you're going to be around for the long term.
Yeah.
So we started sponsoring races and advertising at the race course. You know, a lot of typical clients would be into racing, so it seemed an obvious fit given my love of the game. But there's only so much prize giving you can do on the giving side of the fence. And you know, particularly with smaller owners and syndicates, you know, the joy you saw on people's faces. And the pride and everything that comes with having a winner, you know, it wasn't long before we were kind of thinking, oh, I want to be on the other side as well.
Yeah.
So you know, we just started, you know, having a look on websites and googling for trainers, you know, close to us. We went down on a Saturday morning, I think, to you know, potentially our thought was we'd buy a 5% share in a horse. Which I think I've mentioned to you before, and you know, 4 weeks later we had six of them in total. But
now you've got a string.
But yeah, no, I think it is an expensive industry for owners, and you know, you obviously have to have a fair few quid behind you to get involved fully. You know, I think. You know, there's great work being done on ITV at the moment in terms of educating, you know, the regular, you know, the sort of the average viewer to some of the ins and outs of the industry. But I haven't noticed maybe enough or anything on kind of syndicates and other ownership options. And I think, you know, I'm not saying it's their responsibility, but maybe the rest of us as an industry should, you know, try and, you know, champion ITV to do a little bit more.
Well, especially when you see places like Australia where, you know, the population that has a horse in training is, you know, a much higher percentage than we have here. And
yeah, exactly. Yeah,
you know, obviously then that links into the prize money as well issue, doesn't it? Which, you know, that seems to be a real sticking
point. Yeah, I mean, I don't know whether, you know, there's a perception that the cost of having a horse is all the way up there, and that sort of prohibits people from even making any inquiries.
Sure.
You know, thankfully a few syndicates have won big races recently, obviously. You know, Pall Mall Syndicate in the Guineas, them. but, you know, Onto a Winner did great things with Quiet Reflection. A lot of their horses have won big races. Yeah. So, you know, that's helpful. But I think, you know, just more features on all levels of ownership so that, you know, if there's a perception, it's up there, so I'm not going to get involved.
Yeah.
You know, there are lots of rungs in the ladder to ownership on the way.
Yeah.
I mean, at our level, it is hard because we've got, you know, a lot of horses, and you know, we do spend good money, but we kind of, you know, the horses that we're trying for, in the sales are just horrifically unaffordable because, yes. You know, as much as we'd like, when we don't have many oil wells in Newcastle, and if there are any, I don't own them. You know, at the top level, it is very, very hard to compete in the sales. So I think, you know, the more we can do to encourage people to get involved in syndicates with, you know, relatively affordable horses for them and the syndicate owners, you know, the better. Because then I think, you know, that's when you really get the bug for it.
Yeah,
you know, that's when you really fall in love with racing. Yeah.
You don't mention prize money much when you talk about your part of ownership. Is that something that you just don't even bother factoring into making it pay? Or
oh no, massively factor it into making it pay. Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm not a big fan of Mike Ashley in terms of what he's done at Newcastle United Football Club and. You know, buying cheap horses and flipping them on, and he would buy cheap players and try and flip them on to the big boys. But that's essentially what, Lawrence aside, who has obviously smashed the budget a bit, but, you know, it's generally what we've been trying to do is buy relatively cheap horses that other people, you know, might pay silly money for to help, you know, fund a cost. And to do that, it does mean that we have to move the also-rans on pretty quickly as well.
Yes.
Otherwise, they just drain what others are making for you, and you know. Hopefully, we can keep the odd Lawrence and you know some horses to her. But then the nucleus are going to be, I guess, 80, 90 rated handicappers that can win regularly enough that the prize money covers the cost of keeping them in training.
Yeah.
You know. So the prize money is important.
You know,
but they need to be good enough to win reasonable pots or win pots often enough.
Yeah.
But it's very hard to have a horse good enough to pay its way.
Has she recouped her purchase cost and training fees yet?
Oh yeah, she has. I probably shouldn't say this, but I like logging onto the Racing Post and just having a look at it, because it's like, you know, these mythical, incredible horses and the ridiculous amounts of money they make. Blow your mind, and then you know, kind of log on and have a quick look at Lawrence, and she's thankfully she's paid her way, she's paid her purchase price, and thankfully she's also paid a lot of other horses purchase prices and their training fees, you know. So she, you know, her and a horse we had last year called Beatbox, sort of between the two of them, double-handedly kept the whole operation afloat.
Oh, good.
You know, if it wasn't for the two of them, we really would have struggled.
And we were talking as well there the other day about the state of sales at the moment.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's been a slightly rough ride at the Breeze Ups, very, very, very selective.
Yeah, I noticed that. And you know, I felt a lot of the Breeze Up boys felt it was you know, something unique just to them and just to the Breeze Ups. But you know, I think we've seen over a couple of years now that all sales at all levels are getting harder.
Mm.
And it's becoming more polarised. You know, the really good horses are in demand, are making incredible money on, you know, at one end. And the other ones, you know, if they're not on the big guys' radars, they're making little or no money.
Yeah.
But this is the issue, isn't it? The top 10% is always going to be okay, and it's breaking into that's the issue.
Yeah.
The levels below that you can't seem to get people involved.
There is definitely an overproduction issue. To a certain extent, but I don't think it's solely that. And I think a lot of, you know, and bear in mind that we've sold horses, we're vendors as well, so and we fall into the same traps. But, you know, I think when you see, you know, sort of amazing money being made for a lot of horses, you know, it does seduce you into thinking you're going to get more for yours.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the issues with why there are so many horses at the yearling sales and then why so many yearlings ended up at the Breeze Ups is a lot of vendors were probably asking for too much in the first place. So, you know, the amount of horses sold as a percentage just weren't great. And I don't think that necessarily is down to oversupply. That's more down to, you know, unrealistic expectations from vendors on what they want.
Yeah.
And that trickles through the system as well. So I think when you've got those two forces at work, it does make the sales very hard.
Yes.
For sure.
Yeah.
You know, both as a buyer and a vendor. Sure.
Of course, when it comes to you selling your first large draft of yearlings, you'll be putting six-figure reserves on everything.
I mean, last year was probably our first year of selling a good number of foals. and you know there were definitely some battles between Dan Crichton and Ed Sackville, who advises on a lot of things, and Dan and Josh from Southsea sell the horses for us. There were definitely a few battles between you know those guys and then me, because I was thinking, look, you know, I don't want to be bringing all these horses home
and
sending them to the breeze ups or sending them to another sale.
So you'd sort of, you know, you would be realistic and let them go for a price that maybe doesn't reach your or Dan or Ed's valuation of them.
And I'm not saying I don't think they were worth as much as those two, but I think the level that they're worth and the level at which we need to be happy letting them go are potentially two different things. And you know, sometimes it worked massively in our favour and they made a lot more money than we dreamt. And sometimes it meant we let go of horses cheap, which perhaps annoyed them, but you know, I kind of look at, you know, what have we made on average, and that's the thing that really matters.
So if some dip below, it's not the end of the world, as long as the...
Yeah, it's a bit like the stocks we buy, you know, when we're investing. You know, you can't expect everything to go up, and as long as the ones that do well make more money than the ones that don't, then that's what matters, is the overall return.
And finally in this section, talking about industry things, I wanted to talk about the north of England, because although you don't have a northern accent, you are very much a...
Yeah, I'm a northern boy. I was born in Stockport.
Right.
And then I sort of spent from about 5 to 13 in Bedfordshire, which is probably where I lost my northern accent, and then moved up to Newcastle after that. Yeah. And then I had a stint working in London as well, so, you know, my accent's nondescript.
Yeah.
The more drunk I get, the more Geordie it gets.
Right,
so
okay.
Maybe it's partially suppressed subconsciously, but
right, we'll see later.
We've got
a genuine bona fide northerner here who's going to grill you about your interests in the north.
Well, I mean, just on the state of racing in the north, how do you see the kind of health of that overall? Because I mean, you know, prize money is a nationwide issue, but just in terms of the nuts and bolts of how the north compares to the south,
like you say, I think prize money is definitely a nationwide issue. You know, we've been lucky to dine at the top table a little bit recently, where the prize money's, you know, for want of a better word, it's insane. And there's at the bottom end of the ladder, you know, the lower grade races, it's, you know, it's just so low, it's incredible. We talked about, you know, trying to find horses that can pay their way with prize money. It's very hard because generally at that level prize money is so low. And at the end of the day, majority of horses in training are running at the lower level. And so the majority of people who are working in the industry and are dependent on horses in training and prize money to support it, you know, they're fishing in those lower grade races. You know, the majority of our horses are fishing in those lower grade races. So, you know, it's always frustrating when you hear some headline that, you know, the prize money at Royal Ascot or the Kipco Festival or York's gone up by 40% this year. And you think, well, there's enough money there already. You know, who's going to turn down the hundreds of thousands that's already available for those races? You know, so I think if there was at least a pro rata distribution of these increases in prize money, it would make such a big difference, you know, because, you know, so many races have been run in the north for $3,000, $4,000, and $5,000. It's, you know, they don't go up 40% a year, you know. And I know, you know, a lot of it's down to sponsorship and, you know, those with the deepest pockets want to be seen sponsoring the biggest races, but, you know, perhaps if you sponsor the biggest race, some of that money should be set aside to be added to, you know, the price pots lower down. There needs to be a better trickle-down system, I think, definitely.
Well, especially when you look at the north, the trainers you have in the north, Richard Fahey, Carl Burke, Mark Johnson.
Yeah, I mean...
The talent versus wealth distribution seems to be completely out, because I think the trainers in the north could compete with anyone on the world stage, basically, but the money that they're having to compete for...
It's quite funny, because obviously Mark Johnson's well-supported by... Sheikh Hamdan, etc. And I know, you know, some of the other big owners send, you know, big national owners or big international owners send horses to Richard, and often David O'Meara as well. But a lot of the, you know, really talented trainers, you know, aren't getting the quality of individual that the Southern trainers are. And whether that's because the owners just want to be running at the slightly more glamorous tracks that you typically have in the South, or whether they just don't know that anything exists north of Watford Gap or whatever it might be. But in terms of a training talent pool, you know, we've definitely got some of the best trainers in the country, because you know what the likes of Richard Fahey and Carl Burke are doing with, you know, generally horses that are on a considerably more constrained budget than, you know, the big trainers in the South. You know what they've achieved is incredible, not just in terms of the number of wins, but you know the races they're getting involved in. You know, mixing it with the big boys. You know, it is quite frustrating the way nationally and from a southern basis, the way the North's looked at. We've got a runner in the Woodcote called Cosmic Law, who won at Carlisle recently. And it was fractionally off beating what was a 20-year-old, two-year-old track record.
Right.
It was a very quick time. The runner-up was a Kevin Ryan trader horse. You know, he knows his horses. He's been there, won the Group Ones. They couldn't see theirs getting beaten. Carl Burke, who had the third, thought his was one of the best early two-year-olds he had this year. And I think everyone in the field thought they had a good one.
Yeah.
So in reality, it's probably an awful lot better race than it might have looked.
Yeah.
And, you know, just looking at the build-up to the Woodcote, you know, horses like Cosmic Law get dismissed because they only won at Carlisle. And you just think that's insane because, you know, in the North, Carlisle's, it's a stiff track. It's a long way from, you know, from the South. But a lot of trainers like to send, there's a lot of Northern trainers like to send their good horses to Carlisle.
Yeah.
And it's just this national perception that, well, it's at Carlisle, it can't be a good race. You just think, it's just so derogatory. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
So that just makes you sort of more fired up to, you know, represent the North, and that, yeah, exactly. Stick it to them. Yeah.
We'll have a quick break, and then when we come back, we'll talk about some of the other good horses you've got in training in the North and elsewhere.
Yeah. Thank you.
The Racing Post Bloodstock Postcast is sponsored by Racing FX, the UK's leading money services provider to the equine industry. Manage all your multi-currency needs in one cash manager account and spend anywhere in the world using the Racing FX multi-currency card sponsored by Mastercard. Payments to all service providers in the industry, at home or abroad, are quick and easy to manage via our unique equine network.
Okay, welcome back to the Racing Post Bloodstock Postcast, sponsored by Racing FX. Still here, Martin Stevens, James Thomas, and our special guest, John Dunce. So we're going to go through now some of the other horses you have in training, some of the more exciting ones. The one who went down in many notebooks and would have caught many eyes just a few days ago was New Society, who won by about 10 lengths at Pontefract in the handicap.
Yeah.
Looked like your retained rider, PJ McDonald, was sort of riding him to get him into the Northumberland plate. But
yeah.
What
well, maybe we'll get there one day. Yeah.
What happened?
Well, he's a progressive horse. He only won once last year, but I think other than his last race of the year, he got better with every run. He came closer a couple of times, kept going up the handicap a little bit. But he was only really coming to himself, and he strengthened up beautifully over the winter from 3 to 4. We went to Catterick first time out, and I would confess I didn't think anything about that race suited him. I thought the ground wouldn't suit him. I thought the trip was too short. I thought Catterick would be the worst place in the world to send him. But James Bethel's ability to you know, create a piece of genius that looks like lunacy has no limits. And he absolutely, he kind of bolted up quite easily that day by a couple lengths, three or four lengths. So then we went to Pontefract, still over a mile and four, and you know, I was quite happy with that, because he obviously proved he was okay at the, over that trip. The fact it's quite a stiff finish at Pontefract helped. I thought, well, this is a much more sensible race. And coming up to the home turn, sort of, you know, giving you PJ's feedback, coming up to the home turn, he was getting tapped for toe a little bit as they started squeezing and quickening on the couple of horses in front. So PJ had to get stuck into him pretty quickly because he, you know, he didn't quite have the gears.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, to quote PJ, he said that unfortunately they only quickened for about four strides and then fell in a hole. At which point he's, you know, full steam ahead.
Yeah.
And you know, he had to stay reasonably busy on him. I noticed him put his whip up a few times, look over his shoulder, yeah, and then go, "I'll not bother," and just rode him out.
So how far would he go? In terms of ability, not in terms of mind.
Well, yeah, I mean, how good that race turns out to be, I don't know. I mean, obviously, we were definitely flattered on the day. Mm. But, you know, we do like him. He has progressed with every run. He's much better this year. Whether he makes up into a cult horse is possible. Mm-hmm. He still needs to improve a little bit yet, I think. But I think, he'd definitely make a really nice, top quality handicaps there. I don't think he'd go beyond that.
Yeah.
But I think in the big handicaps, he might be a great horse to have on the team.
Yeah.
A proper Saturday horse, which PJ had to mention to James when he came into the winner's enclosure, and James said, "Well, am I going to go with him?" there's a nice race for him at Ayr, mid to late June, 0-100 for a 40k pot. So, mm-hmm. If he got anywhere in the first two, he sort of paid for his year's training fees as well. So that'd be a nice one.
Another progressive young middle distance horse you've got, Celestial Force. What's the latest on him?
Yeah, he's a lovely horse. I really like him. I feel a bit devastated in myself to let him go off at 16-1 or 20-1 first time out, because he needed a lot of time. And Tom Dascombe's team did a fantastic job with him last year and over the winter. And they just lots of steady work, lots of core conditioning. Never pressed any buttons. They knew he needed time.
Yeah.
Obviously they did great with Brown Panther, but I think, Tom and his team aren't necessarily well known for that type of horse and that type of regime, and they were brilliant with him. But first time out, there were a couple of Derby entries in there. John Gosden's horse was relatively high in the betting. Carl wouldn't have kept his in first time out unless he really fought an awful lot of it. And he'd done a bit of a poor piece of work about 2 weeks before.
Right.
And it was probably the first time he'd galloped properly. And so I felt a little bit deflated. Tom was still, the most confident man in the world. We had a lot of guests there that day. We had a sort of work day, and they were saying, should we back this horse? And I said, he's a bit green, he needs the experience, and there's some good horses in this. So I didn't back him, and I came back in and sort of said, "Oh, I'm so sorry." And they went, "Oh, we backed him." So so I missed the trick there. But he's a nice horse. He obviously beat some good horses there. I think a few, fought quite highly of their second time out at Thirsk, where he won under a penalty. And in both instances, he put jockey through the ringer, who he looked like he'd had a proper race. Horse was relaxed, not sweating, not blowing. Jockey exhausted. He's still got a huge amount to learn. In the ideal world, we'll go for the Melrose with him, and we'll probably have to get him out in a handicap before that, get him in a big field, because he has got an awful lot to learn. He kind of hits the front and starts hesitating and start asking the jockey what he should do now. And again, it's a bit like Lauren's recent victories. It's only when the horses start attacking him from all sides he realizes we're racing and goes again.
I mean, how far do you think he can go again in terms of ability?
I think he could be a pattern performer. I really do. We haven't ruled out the St. Ledger yet.
Okay.
I think we've entered him in the Irish St. Ledger as well, which would be a brave shout as a three-year-old. But
he's very well bred, isn't he? You didn't pay too much for him considering his pedigree.
No, certain extent we stole him. He's got some good siblings. And he's got a few that were a bit disappointing as well.
Right.
So I think there was maybe a little bit of, which direction will this one be in?
Yeah.
He was very I didn't buy him for myself. Buy him from the sales myself. Ed Sackville bought him.
Yeah.
And he didn't buy him for me. Bought him for Tom. And
right.
We went to the yard, and he was still for sale at that point. Right. And he was very raw, but. You could see he had a great physique.
Mm.
He could grow into a great physique. He had a great shape about him, great hip, and he sort of struck me in a not dissimilar way to Lawrence, although he wasn't quite as well bodied as she was at the time. But so we were quite lucky, and that was obviously quite handy that it was still Ed and ourselves.
Yeah,
But hopefully he'll be one for pattern races in time. But he's just got so much to learn in the meantime. That's the only problem.
I saw you had an intriguing entry this week coming. That's the three-year-old filly with Hugo Palmer, Minovia, by Caradac of all.
Yes. So there's a bit of a story. This is a good bloodstock story. Actually.
Oh, good. Yeah, we like that.
We had a very nice 2 and 3 year old called My Amigo.
Yes.
Who was by stimulation, who wasn't very trendy, but he was a big, beautiful horse. Mm-hmm. Who he went on debut. He looked like he should gallop a mile. He went on debut over 6 and then won a Weatherby handicap off mid to high 80s over 5.5 furlongs. He was an incredible horse. But after his first run, and this was credit to Dan Crichton, he found a sister to the dam in a field in Spain. We talk about having connections, contacts. And she was, I think she was listed placed, and she'd had a listed place horse, so it was kind of a off the radar pedigree. And we generally thought My Amigo would go on to be a listed group horse. We had a few issues with him, with sort of tonsillitis type thing, and he needed gelding, and he didn't took him a long time to get over that. And he's with Marjorie Fife now, and starting to rediscover his form again. So we look a bit silly there. So that was my fault. Sorry, Carl. But yeah, so we found this sister in a field, and she was in foal to Caradac. Might have been Caradac at foot, actually.
Right, yeah.
She was in foal to something else, fairly exotic, but she had this Caradac at foot, and as a foal, she was absolutely beautiful.
Yeah.
A real sort of roan. She's become quite grey as time's gone on. She's taken a long time to come to hand. About this time last year, Hugo and ourselves were questioning whether she'd even make a racehorse. She probably hadn't grown much from when she was a yearling, but she's over the last 12 months she's grown. So we'll see how she goes. Yeah. But so we didn't ever bred her, but we do still have the dam, who's just had a Star Spangled Banner.
Oh, very
filly,
good. Yeah.
Who is obviously also by Choisir.
Yes.
Who My Amigo was, Stimulation was by. So that's
all coming together.
Yeah.
If I didn't say that, filly's name is Minovia, who's entered this week with Hugo Palmer.
Yes. Which is Portuguese for my friend.
Oh, very good.
My Amigo, you see.
Very clever. You don't just throw it all together.
Don't make this stuff up, you know.
So we've actually only got 5 minutes until the Woodcut Stakes when you've got a runner, so we're going to go and watch that. What are you going to treat us to if Cosmic Law wins?
A running man. I've got a friend that's getting very angry with me for not doing the running man yet, because it's something I'd never done the robot until I did it live on TV. And obviously you can watch how badly executed it is and probably testify that that's true, yeah. But my friend and I, he always used to do the running man, and he's very annoyed that I've not done that on TV yet. So
well, for when Lawrence wins the Classic, maybe.
Yeah, I think that would be apt. Yeah.
And the French will look at you like
I'll shake your hand on that now. I'll do the running man for the
Shanty
Diane.
They'll throw you out. But never mind. Yeah. thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me in.
Good luck with Lawrence through the season and all the other horses. And thanks for watching.
The Racing Post Bloodstock Postcast is sponsored by Racing FX, the UK's leading money services provider to the equine industry. Manage all your multi-currency needs in one cash manager account and spend anywhere in the world using the Racing FX multi-currency card sponsored by MasterCard. Payments to all service providers in the industry at home or abroad are quick and easy to manage via our unique equine network.